What is happening? Welcome to another episode of The Craft. My name is Nick Pollock, and it is PitchCon live. So who better to bring to The Craft to PitchCon than the person who was
could it be now?
From all the way back? You might not remember him. He was only here in the first episode. It's Eno Saris. Eno.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. And we are going to talk our rankings today. It is January 31st. So these are not finalized by either of us. It also means that we haven't made full assessments on the injury status of a lot of pitchers. It also means we don't know any extra news from February or March about who's winning those rotation battles, who's actually healthy and going to be fine. There are a lot of questions that still aren't answered, and it's one of my least favorite parts about doing our rankings in early February, putting them out, because then they so quickly get changed based on all this extra information. However, there are some guys that Eno and I have different opinions on, or at least perspectives on. And what I love about this is I'm going to be certainly shifting my rankings one way or another through this conversation today. So Eno and I each took five guys while looking at each other's lists. They're like, okay, these are the ones we want to talk about. And Eno, who is your first pitcher that you just got to talk to me about?
Oh, let's start with the super boring, the most boring, the most. He's not going to be on any key, on any sleeper lists. He has a very sort of narrow use case that I will lay out for you in a second. But Mitch Keller, come on down.
Oh, my gosh.
Mitch Keller, come on down.
Okay. Eno.
I have him around 95. And you have him around 191. So okay. It is one of the biggest differences in the rankings right now.
Okay. I gotta say something there. That was October. And okay. And what I do in October, there are certain groupings that I make of just like all of them are in this tier at this moment. And I'm just kind of shoving them there, which includes prospects who might be coming up, an injury tier of just like they're injured and we don't know.
He's in your boring old guy tier or something.
Yeah. And the thing is, in a 12 teamer, you know, should Mitch Keller be drafted?
Yeah, I don't know. That's what I was going to say. My use case is very specific. Like right now, if you're listening to this and you are drafting in late January, most likely what you're drafting is called a draft and hold. It's like a one where you don't get any free agent moves and you have 50 rounds. And in those leagues, I love Mitch Keller because Mitch Keller over the last four seasons has had a 3.52 ERA at home. And I think that he's a guy that you can plug in for 100, you know, of his innings, 100 of his 150, 160 innings. He's good for innings. He's been a workhorse. And so, you know, worst case, you throw him away sometimes when you don't want to, but you get the innings for it. I think you'd end up with basically 120, 130 innings of like a 3.75 ERA if you used him correctly. I'm not really calling for much more because right now we just did a retrain of the Stuff Plus model. He only has one pitch that has above a 90 Stuff Plus now.
Oh my God.
It's, you know which one it is. It's the
it's got to be a sweeper.
Yeah, it's the sweeper. Yeah. But even that, the sweeper got dialed down because in the retrain, all sweepers took a little bit of a hit.
Yeah.
Finally, Luis Severino went down.
I mean, it's because it wasn't like a funny sweeper, the one that we modeled it off of. I mean, at least for us, it was like the only obvious one was that. And it was like, well, okay, this is not helpful.
Yeah, right. So, yeah. I mean, if I had his ear, I'd probably bring back the cutter and have him, you know, throw cutter, four seam against lefties, sinker, four seam against righties, plus the sweeper and not too much of the other stuff. But, you know, I'm not calling for much upside. I'm just saying super useful. Now, 12 teamer, that's a streamer situation, right? That's like use him when he's home. Yeah,
that's a little bit of a difference. That means he lives on the wire. And I mean, I don't know if it's going
to
be ultimately.
But to be fair, where I have him 95, like how many pitchers do you need from 95 in a 12 teamer, like rank 95?
Right. Yeah. So it's interesting. People say like, okay, let's say you get 8 starters. I mean, you won't really, you probably go like 7 in a 12 teamer, but let's say it's 8, then that's 96 for 12 teams. Right.
He would be a terrible last starter in a 12 team league.
Like absolutely.
In my preamble and as in yours, like, you know, we sort of lay out that, like, you know, you should do different things at different places in your rankings, depending on like what your bias is. I mean, like I have around him, like Andrew Painter, I have kind of close to him you know, but that would be a much better 12 team final pick.
Well, right. I mean, that's the kind of, I guess what I'm getting at is we're always balancing the risk and reward. Okay, so if I'm going to take this, what are the chances this is helpful for me? If this doesn't work out, what are my backup options, et cetera, mm-hmm. right? And so Painter, for me, we're talking about Keller being a streamable guy at home. I have to believe that in season, you're going to find a comparable option. It's not like it's only Mitch Keller as this golden thing. So then I'm like, fine, I'll just try Painter then. At least I have that as opposed to... That's really where that mindset comes
from.
One
place where we might disagree is with, like, if you were in a 15 team league with free agency, I might still keep Mitch Keller on my team.
Right.
He'd be one of those guys I keep on my team. Okay. Don't drop, you know, so Paul Spohr calls them team streamers, where he's like, you don't play them every time, but you keep them on your team.
Right. So that's kind of like the NFBC format where you have these 6 benches. It's a weekly thing as well.
Yeah.
And with Mitch Keller on the whole, I really do have to note that since he became a full-time starter really in 21, he's had one season under a 4.19 ERA, and that was a 3.91, and knows whip better than 125. And I say this a lot of, you know, I understand wins are an important thing. He had 113 win season, 111, sure, but it was 6 last year, 32 starts. Those guys are not valuable volume that we like to think, especially when he's coming with like 20% K rate as well. It's in many ways just making you struggle more. Like having a 125 whip or so is not really what you want, even in a 15 team where you want someone that would push it the other way. So now it's just more below the aces that you have. That's kind of how I think about this a bit, is you don't want to like have these anchors if it's not giving you enough on the other side of it.
I'd definitely still be careful with him. I could do better than the one, than that whip. The home whip. Let's see here.
It is, to your point, it's like, cool, you're not, you know, I'm talking about it more of like, if you're just starting him every time, you're saying being selective with it, which I think is absolutely the way to go. And there's also a benefit here to Mitch Keller.
The home whip is not great, actually. It's a good point. The home whip is still 1.24. So,
the thing that we haven't talked about that is a point in favor of Mitch Keller is there is this idea that he will not be a Pittsburgh Pirate forever, right? Mm. That it will be dangled.
Oh, I don't know if that's in his favor. That's worse. I like him at home.
Pirate. The idea is that you leave the Pirates and maybe there's something to tinker, something to fix, something that, you know, the Yankees have been associated with him a ton. You just think that like Mitch Keller, oh man, all these years, what if he had, you know, really leaned in that sweeper more and developed that cutter, the curveball more. It's always felt like there should be another level that he's never hit. So that could happen, possibly. That does shape his season as well, especially in that draft and hold. Maybe in the second half, he's not in Pittsburgh anymore. I'm just going to do the quick transition here and just get the Pirates out of the way, because this is a conversation that we've been having since the mock draft at PitcherList, where we did all the podcast network, all these podcasts. We came together. We did a mock draft back in like October, November, someone where I took Junior Caminero, everyone. And you know, I think you took Braxton Ashcraft in like the 16th round, 17th round of that in a 12 teamer. I am more convinced in favor of Braxton than I was back then, though I am not as convinced as you are. And you have him at 53. And I want you to talk about that.
I Yes. So right around 53, there is for me a little bit of an injury tier. Braxton Ashcraft comes right behind Bryce Miller, Brandon Woodruff, even Gavin Williams, I think, is a bigger injury risk than people think. He's right ahead of Shane Bieber and Carlos Rodon. And so what I think of there is, you know, the new 200 innings is 150 innings.
Oh,
and
man.
We had Hunter Green last year as a top 15 overall starting pitcher with like 105 innings or something. And I'm not saying that Braxton Ashcraft is Hunter Green. I'm just saying, let's say he only gives you 120 innings this year. He might be good enough to be a top 50 pitcher. And that's what I'm saying with those players in that area. Mm-hmm. I recognize the injury risk. I have him down for 131. I've done some hand projecting of injuries of innings. And I love it because I'm just like, 132, you know, No. 131.
Cause yeah, you know, we're going to figure out three outs, guys. We know it. We initially had projections at like 31.3.
Oh, give like you half ammo. Outs.
What are we doing here? We are going to round this. Oh gosh. Yeah. It's so funny when you think about it. Like, guys, we're literally predicting 1/5 inning. You know, somewhere in August.
Yeah.
Like how could we possibly? Yeah.
And just so that, I mean, I don't know if this is where you're headed, but the injury history on Braxton Ashcraft is pretty extensive. He had Tommy John in 2021, lost 2022 to it. He had surgery in 2019 on his non-throwing shoulder. And then in 2020, he had knee meniscus surgery, and that knee has bothered him since off and on. And in 2024, he missed most of the season, actually, with recurring right forearm tightness and elbow inflammation. So, you know, what's funny is I have these injury grades from Jeff Zimmerman. He does not necessarily have all the minor league injury history. So he already has, I'm not saying that he has like an A on him. He has like basically like a B on Braxton Ashcraft, but I'd give Braxton Ashcraft like a D health grade.
Yeah.
But great new sinker, you know, I love the sinker. I love the curveball. I think it's one of the elite pitches among, it reminds me a little bit of when Kyle Bradish was, you know, throwing the big breaking ball and needed to figure out the fastballs around it. I think that Braxton Ashcraft is throwing this big breaking ball and he's like, oh, if I can do sinker and four seam around this big breaking ball, I can make it work. So I think the whole arsenal works, and hey, give me 130 innings and I think he'll be a top 50 pitcher.
Man. Okay. So my initial comp is one that I'm taking back. I just want to let you guys know, you're going to be upset at me when I say this. All right. And I'm already upset at myself. But I just want to work through my thought process. Is the person, the pitcher that he reminds me the most of initially is Wascar Ynoa, because his slider is amazing. It's a 92 mile per hour slider. He throws it for strikes. It's great. And Wascar Ynoa was able to dial it up to like 98, 99. Like he was able to throw hard with his four seamer, but he got hit really hard. And that's actually what it is with Braxton Ashcraft, right? It's a high strike rate, but low swing strike rate on it. It gets hit 45% ICR. It's a low PLV. It's just not a good four seamer. And that was my initial, like, yeah, that's just kind of who he is. Also, you throw in the fact of the Pirates have been babying him. I wasn't even really going to bring up the injury. It was just more of that he hasn't pitched enough yet.
Yeah, just didn't have volume.
It's under 70 innings last year in the majors. I don't really think that the Pirates are going to just let him fly, honestly. I feel like there's going to be some sort of limitations, and I do question, of course, if he can do that. It's not like a guy going 120, 130 as a starter in the majors and then doing it. When he pitched in the majors this past year, they were severely limiting him. Actually, I remember the Bubba Chandler debut was so frustrating because it was the first game that Braxton was able to go like 5 innings in full. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, you're supposed to be, where's Bubba? He was just pitching too well against those Rockies. So it's not really something that I would buy into, is that this is a 6-inning guy constantly. It just doesn't.
I mean, he didn't hit six innings once last year.
And there you go. And the other aspect that I'm more sold on is, as you mentioned with his sinker, that he is throwing this now to righties 25% of the time. As the year went on, I imagine, I think that he did increase it deeper into the season. Yes, it became his primary fastball. So 46% and 41%, 36% his last three games. He had two more above 30% before that. And so that's good because he does get decent movement. It's not elite movement. It's like 16 inches of horizontal in this sinker, but it does land in the zone more effectively for strikes. It is a weaker contact inducer. So this is Braxton Ashcraft's arsenal against righties is great. Slider is great. Sinker is great. Fine. Even though I don't absolutely believe in the sinker fully, fine. Lefties, I'm not as sold. He's trying to throw this curveball for strikes. He can't get it over 60%, and it's still not a high swing strike rate pitch. It should be great. It's like 84, 85. And like we see, like, oh man, that's a really hard curve. But
I believe in that curveball.
Oh, it looks so good. But he doesn't command it. I mean, I think that's one of the things too about Braxton is that I don't believe that this is a guy who can spot these pitches constantly, which then leads to more inefficiency and also you throw in the lack of volume, et cetera, et cetera. And then the sinker doesn't show up right against lefties because that's just traditionally what happens. And the four seamers is better against lefties than it is against righties. It's still, to me, not a good four seamer. It's just velocity and then it's empty velocity. And we've seen that not necessarily work as well. So that's kind of where I am. It's like it's a package that still has question marks in command and just a proper attack to each side. You also throw in lower win chance, not just from volume per game, but also based on the team. Have a D-grade injury history. It's too many things that need to go right. But then again, his slider is just like so good and he throws hard.
Yeah, I love the, I mean, for me, it's the curveball. Oh, this is great timing.
Is that you or me?
That's that you. Is me. Okay. Please. Oh, thank God. Okay. I believe in the curveball. I think the slider is basically a cutter. I know it has sliderish movement, but it had really, and I know we don't like to quote, you know, on-field results too much for pitch types, but it did well against lefties. And so it has the type of shape that, you know, it's a gyro, hard gyro, right? And those usually are platoon neutral. So, you know, in my mind, if I'm Braxton Ashcraft, I'm considering the slider a cutter against lefties, and I'm cutter curveball with the four seam as more a swinging strike out of the zone pitch. I don't have to command. I'm using the slider for strikes. I'm using the curveball for swing and miss, and I'm using the four seam for swing and miss, and trying to really make that my third most used pitch. So it'd be a little bit different than he was last year, but not that much. The curveball he used almost as much as the four seam last year against lefties. And against righties, I think he's got a pretty complete arsenal, actually. Sinker, slider, curveball, four seamer. He can use all of them against righties. And so, you know, I did just move him down a little bit. I moved him down to another injury tier I have, closer to like Sean Manaea, Jared Jones, and Garrett Cole. Those are really hard for us to rank in any given season because we don't know how many innings. We just don't know what their health situation is.
I obviously treat them differently of like Sean Manaea and Ashcraft. I would say, like, cool, let's just see how this is going. Mm-hmm. And then we quickly drop. Well, the other one is, all right, we're either in to hold this or not.
Garrett Cole.
Yeah, Garrett Cole and Jared Jones. We just don't know when they're going to return.
Yeah.
So it's I would have different tiers just for that, like they're being treated differently, but I understand value wise that it's similar.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're talking about 100 to 120 innings from a lot of those guys, and they might all be pretty good. You know, like I'll get the order down as much as I can, but I think I try to think of it as like, there's just this obvious push and pull between quantity and quality. And it's really hard to kind of dial in. But it just generally, I have much more an ear for now for guys that I have only projected for 130 innings. Because I think the most you can expect, I mean, I think you should expect 150, 160 innings from even your studs.
You know, so. It really hurts saying hearing a 150 is the new 200. I'm like, oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Oh no. So I wanna hear from you. The one that's like, Nick, please, you gotta be ridiculous here. You gotta get on board with this. I wanna hear the emotion. I wanna hear the ire inside of you.
I'm taking one of yours then.
Go ahead.
The one of your names that you came up with before.
Yeah, please.
Shota Imanaga.
Oh, come on.
Really? Come on, dude. Come on, dude.
First, tell everybody where you have him ranked.
Where do I have him ranked? Let me see here.
Yeah. Oh.
I have him 71.
71, you know.
71.
71.
Okay. So, over the course of last year, he lost ticks on his fastball. He had a 450 ERA in the second half. It really didn't look like it was going to work. The home run rate doubled in the second half. He had given up more than two homers for nine in the second half. Over the course of that season versus the season before, he is now a 30-year-old who lost 5 percentage points on his strikeout rate. With 130 innings in both seasons, there have been 12 guys who have done this since 2015. That have had that much of a drop. Of the 12 guys, 9 were done. Of the 12 guys, 9 were done. And I'm lumping in done for fantasy and just done retired done. But the only guys that gave you good fantasy seasons after that were Mike Fiers, gave you 2 more good fantasy seasons. Cole Hamels gave you 2 more good fantasy seasons. And I guess I don't know if my math is completely right here, but I have 0.5 more good seasons for Jeremy Hellickson and Corey Kluber.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. That just gives you an idea. Just gives you the names on this list. The names on this list are James Shields, Andrew Kashner, Marco Estrada, J.A. Happ, Anibal Sanchez, Masahiro Tanaka did it the year he left. Marco Gonzalez, like it's Martin Perez. It's not a good list. It's not a good list.
Wow. This hurts. I'm going to tell you a few things that make him different. But I also want to just tell you, do you know what the nickname I had for Jeremy Hellickson was? It was the devil. Because he would, this was back, this is like the first year. This is 2014 pitcher gifts. Okay.
Yeah.
Because what would happen is that he would look so tempting, so convincing. So you'd invite him into your village before he burns it down. Because it would be like a 6 earned run game after that, you know. Yeah. This was really before cherry bomb was a term that I had. It was just Jeremy Hellickson. Of course, he has hell in his name. All right. So Shota Imanaga can be really explained simply here of you allowed too many home runs in that second half off of his four-seamer. And his put away rates were far below what you should expect what he's doing. Put away rate to me is a really great indicator to say what is the regression we should expect. Because if you have a really low put away rate suddenly on a pitch in a certain scenario, like his four seamer did, then what that does is A, it extends at bats. So you labor more.
And it means something about the quality of the pitch, right?
Sure, absolutely. But when it's so low, I mean, it often became like a 12% put away rate on a four seamer, which is just, whoa, hold on a second. Like when you throw those pitches in 2 strike counts, generally we see that 17% put away rate or so. And to see like a 40% drop in that is just, okay. Also, the splitter did too. And I think that goes in tandem. And that became suddenly a below average splitter put away rate in the second half.
I bet you the swing rate tanked.
And right, because what I see is he has volatility a little bit on the splitter, and that really affected everything else with it too.
He really is a two pitch guy.
Well, no, he's a 3. He has the slider.
Slider sweeper thing.
Yeah. But I think the biggest difference between Imanaga and these others is that his whip is still elite. It's still, he limits the base runners a lot. And the 450 ERA in the second half, sure, I get that. And the strikeout rate went down. I think it's a positive regression coming for the strikeout rate. I'm not saying he's going to be 26. I'm just saying he's going to be a strikeout an inning 22, 23, right? I see a Holly. I see a guy who's going to be going in front of an amazing defense once again with the Cubs in an incredible scenario. You want to pitch for the Cubs where it should be fewer home runs as it was on the four seamer in that second half. He should have a little bit more strikeouts. He should still be really good at limiting base runners. So even if you want to say it's going to be a four ERA for Imanaga for the year, fine. But I will tell you that it will be at 150 innings or so. It should be there. It should be with double digit wins. It should be with a good whip, like a 115 or lower, you know, right? It should be good and help you. That to me is valuable still. And home runs are the noisiest stat of any. When it comes to just stickiness over year to year, when we talk about like the major ones. So combine that with a strikeout rate that I feel like is going to be a little bit better. Yeah, I'm in on Imanaga.
I didn't just tank him all the way out of my top 100. So, you know, I am reacting also to the projections I have. He's not ranked inappropriately for my projections. For Matt Boyd, I mean, I hew pretty closely to Oopsie because Oopsie projections have my stuff plus in them. They even have starting next week, early in the week, they'll have the stuff plus retrain in them. And that's what I'm looking at while I'm making my rankings. And for him, I have a 4.34 projection from Oopsie. Based on his stuff. There was something I was looking at, like Matt Boyd, I am, as are you, a Boyd boy.
let's go.
But I have Boyd actually somewhat close to him, and I was looking at some of the splits on the Wrigley pitchers, and it occurred to me that I think that I like. And this is especially relevant for certain leagues where trading is rampant and loud. And, if you're in a home league situation, I actually think that Boyd and, you know, Shota and like some of these Cubs pitchers are good pickups for early in the year. Wrigley is cold and they've all had good splits. Boyd had great first half splits.
Yeah.
His second half wasn't as good. And what you could do is kind of get out in front of it. And there's actually a little bit of science to this. There's a cool piece on Fangraphs called "The Park Factors Are in the Pudding" from last year by Kiri Oler. And they looked at monthly park factor deviation from overall park factor. So to get a sense of how, like, you know, which parks really changed over the course of the year. Mm-hmm. And, I'm not telling anybody that lives in Chicago anything they don't know, but it's cold in April. It even gets a little cold in September. So what you have in May is Wrigley plays 5 points down from its overall park factor in April and May, and 7 points up in June. And it's up in June, July, and August. And then September again, it goes back down. So I believe that's probably a wind pattern situation or a temperature thing. And that probably factored a little bit into what happened with Shota last year. Yeah, you know, the ball starts leaving the park a little bit more, you know, in the warmer weather, you know. So there could be a case for, you know, draft these guys early, especially if they drop a little in your league, especially if someone's using my rankings in your league, then maybe take Shota, like enjoy a couple months. And then I would say, you know, get out in front of it, because even the guys that had good seasons after these drops, like I said, Kluber and Fires, they didn't have a lot of good seasons. So, you know, if Shota has a good beginning of the season this year and you're in a keeper league, I would be tempted to shop him pretty hard.
Well, so at the very least, I'm looking at mine right now for Shota, and I've moved him to like the mid 40s. I have him around there
now. Okay. You argued my Braxton down. I'm not moving him back up. You didn't convince me.
71.
Yeah, I'm going to keep him down there. I don't know.
You rather have Sean Manaea?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have a 3.8 projection on Sean Manaea. Maybe someday he'll come up with a good secondary pitch, right?
we're going to shift to another starter. Noah Cameron, just kind of on the same topic, I think, of like slower throwing lefties, right? Mm-hmm. And I think Noah Cameron is a really hard one to grasp because it was the year of the swatch, the southpaw with the tight changeup. And we also have Kansas City changing the fences a little bit. Does that mean that we're going to get more home runs from Noah Cameron? It was about a 120 homer per nine last season, only a 20% K rate. It's not the most appealing set of peripherals with around a 7 hit per 9 that you might think might go up a little bit. 84% left on base rate. Like, this feels like someone who didn't quite deserve what they'd had, you know, just even the standard 418 FIP, which I don't like quoting because we understand the underlying numbers, but still, that's just the very simple grasp of those numbers I just gave you. 241 BABIP. But there is something about what Noah Cameron did that is good, clearly, because it was the same model of a lot of other pitchers. And I think that you have Cameron lower than I do, because you're not buying any of it for the most part, or at least like I'm sure the projections aid. I don't have it right in front of me right now. I should. I wanted to really hear your whole thought process on Noah Cameron.
Yeah, the park was part of it. And actually, this one might go up a little bit, but you know,
133, by the way, 133 for Noah Cameron.
Yeah, I have a 4.66 ERA projection, so it's going to be hard for me to push him even into the top 100. Like, I don't have anybody in the top 100 that has an ERA projection. The closest, Andrew Painter, who's a rookie, so I'm discounting that projection. The worst ERA that I ERA projection I have in the top 100 is 98, Luis Gil with 4.39. So, you know, could I get him into the 10, the small 105? Like Andrew Abbott, I have at 106 with a 4.53 ERA projection. Okay, I can put Cameron next to him. In fact, Noah Cameron next to Andrew Abbott makes some sense as command lefties that have outproduced models and outproduced
Andrew Abbott at 106. Yeah, you don't care. Swatch. I don't.
Well, here's a fun thing though. So we did retrain the model and, you know, the Stuff Plus model. And in the past, we've already had to make the adjustment where we just, we basically put as a feature in the model, is this person a left-handed pitcher?
Yeah, like, right.
Because we found that lefties just outperform the model. And we already had that in the model, but when we retrained the model, 7 of the 10 starters that moved the most in Stuff Plus were left-handers.
Hmm.
Noah Cameron himself went up 2 points of Stuff Plus from 94 to 96. And, you know, maybe just an overall 96 Stuff Plus with good command normally in that park would be somebody I'd be really interested in. I don't know what that park is right now. And even on the retrain, none of his hard pitches did well. So basically, he's got really good, you know, a really good sort of curve and change combo. I don't even know. I think the slider's okay, but you know, with the curve and change, I think what he's just doing is putting those on the outside corner to righties. And, you know, he's trying to do strikes with the curve a little bit more and non-strikes with the changeup a little bit more. They kind of going in different directions, but he kind of just plays with slow on the outside corner. I think they basically, what the argument here with Cameron is that his slow stuff tunnels off each other. In a way that we don't capture really well in models. And I get that as an argument because, you know, Trevor Rogers told me last year, when I throw too many changeups and I didn't have the sweeper, people just spit on everything low. So then I started throwing the sweeper, they spit on something low, and they took the sweeper for a called strike. So tunneling on secondary pitches exists. It's really hard to model because it's basically sequencing at that point or something. Because the traditional model of tunneling is you're locked into the fastball. You want to hit the fastball. You want the pitches to look like the fastball as long as possible until the decision point, and then you screw up the decision point for the batter. I'm not saying that's incorrect. I'm just saying that also now happens because we have hitters now being more anticipatory about pitches. So now they're like, I'm waiting on the Noah Cameron changeup. I'm going to hit the Noah Cameron changeup. And instead, it's the curve, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm making your side of the argument.
No. I appreciate it. Appreciate you. So he's this is the toughest thing, I think, for us is like, I know it might be kind of wild to hear, but I am innately a stuffist. Mm-hmm. And what I've tried to do is pull myself, like, make all the arguments on the other side, because I have to swing the pendulum the other way as much as I can. And when we talked about the season in review in October and the lessons we learned, one of the things that my takeaways really from that conversation was upside comes in different forms. Of it's not just the stuff guys getting high strikeouts, it's targeting the volume and quality volume that actually can appear, that is not like the Framber side of it, but the second tier of it. And that was like the Matthew Boyds, the Merrill Kelly.
Yeah. Kelly, I mean, right? In the deep leagues, Mitch Keller for me, it's like, okay, like, right. There's no reason to really love him, but he's got this use case.
Opportunity is the thing. Yeah, it's not like a sixth ERA or something. And I get that.
Usefulness to fantasy people, even if he's not going to turn into an ace.
Right.
Like, we're always like looking for like, oh, the next Christopher Sanchez. Well, yeah. Noel Cameron is not the next Christopher Sanchez.
Well, Sanchez was actually in that second tier we were talking about in October, because he was like, you know, he was my 35th starter or whatever, which was the consensus 45 or whatever it was. And yeah, there you go. Right. It wasn't the premium. Oh, he's my safe, you know, top 20 anchor. But it's
there's nobody that looks like Noel Cameron in your top 15.
Right. Right. There's no way. It can't happen. But
he could have a top 15 season randomly. Like Seth Lugo had a top 15 season and like, yeah.
Right. Now I say that the stuffist, no, but PLV obviously is not just pure stuff. It is also location and context a little bit of when they throw it. It calls Noah Cameron's cutter the 94th percentile cutter.
Wow.
And it's because of where he locates it. It is so good. To right-handers, it is his best pitch. It is a 540 PLV, with 5 being like pretty much like the middle ground of it. I kind of see that. I know it sounds weird. I see that kind of like as a 140 plus or something like that. Like every number from 5, every decimal point or 0.1 is like is 1 on that scale to me. So seeing a 540, I'm just like, whoa, what's he do? He throws 4 seamers upstairs. And the cutter comes completely off of that inside beautifully. I mean,
and then he's doing the changeup and curve on the outside corner. Yeah.
And the changeup and curve on the outside corner, exactly. And not one of his four-seamer curveball changeup, which are all 90% of his pitches to right-handers, had an ICR above 35%. That's ideal contact rate. That is, you want to be under 35%, right? Sorry, 35.3 on the cutter. But it's... these are all pitches that have induced weak contact, and they're all within 20 to 25% usage.
Yeah.
So his game plan against righties was legit. Now, is it as legit as a sub 3 ERA? No, I don't necessarily, I'm not going to tell you that. I do believe that this is a sub 4 ERA pitcher. I do like, based on this, like he is a command artist. He is a wide arsenal guy. And if there's any concern, really, it might be with left-handers, because it's really just that cutter that is incredibly effective. I mean, the curveball has too. It's gotten enough strikes, like 61% strikes, low.
My model likes the slider,
And the cutter is great against it. Four-seamer, though, is thrown 34% of the time.
His four-seam's not good.
It's not good. So I'm just actually surprised he doesn't throw a sinker. Like,
yeah. And maybe that's what he'll come to camp with. But just a point in your favor, despite a 94 stuff plus on the revamp with the cutter for Noah Cameron, it's a 103 location plus. And this is one of those pitches that I think is fascinating to think about. So 94 stuff plus, 103 location plus, but 108 pitching plus.
Ooh.
Which is sort of like your PLV, right? Like,
yeah.
What pitching plus does, it's a third model. It's not just like 1+1 divided by, right. You know, it's a whole nother model that says, looking at locations, thinking of platoon splits, thinking of the stuff, thinking of the usage, thinking of all of the process underneath, like basically it's like PLV, and thinking about how this pitch is used, how good is it? And it says it's second best pitch. So
what's the first best?
The model says by pitching plus says the slider.
I mean, a slider, the slider for us is,
but it always great loves too. Sliders.
Yeah. I mean, against lefties, he throws it 29% of the time and it's effective because it's a slider to lefties. Yeah. It was a lefty. So, I mean, all encompassing here, what I see is Cameron, who's going to go consistently. Like, he was a quality start darling, 10 quality starts last year out of nowhere for a lot of guys, especially as he got ramped up. And it's a 20% K rate. And there's this understanding, oh, he's a soft tossing lefty. Like, this is what he is. I'm not saying he's going to be much higher or is going to be higher at all. I'm not ready to say that this sophomore
isn't going to work. Yeah,
exactly. He's not going to find something a little bit more to get more comfortable with it.
Well, I moved him up next to Andrew Abbott because it makes just too much sense. And I would just say that him and Andrew Abbott are the most frustrating watches for me.
Yeah, as, always have been. I've been talking about Abbott since 22 or whatever.
I know, but I'm also yelling at the hitters. I'm like, why didn't you swing at that?
Yeah, yeah.
That four-seamer was right down the pipe. Come on. What are you doing? I've even asked players about it.
Yeah, what they
I
say?
Was like, Wilmer Flores, man. Andrew Abbott. I don't get it. Tell me. Yeah. And he goes, well, he's got, you know, a couple good pitches. He commands them both. And I'm like,
you shouldn't have asked Wilmer. You should have asked someone else.
Thanks. Yeah. No, Wilmer's actually fairly smart, but I think also no hitter really wants to tell you why a pitcher is good.
Yeah, oh, that's interesting.
It's too much in their like approach, and like maybe a retired hitter you get a little bit more out of.
Like you finally got David Ortiz saying the five toughest pitchers after the fact, you know.
Yeah, he's not gonna tell you in the they don't love it in the fact. Like I was talking to Josh Donaldson once about two strike approach, and he's like, I have to stop you right now. And I was like, what? And he's like, no hitter will ever talk to you about their two strike approach. If they do, they're lying and they're telling you nothing, because we don't want anyone to know what our two strike approach is.
Yeah, well, that's fair. Hey. That is that. I mean, I get that, because like this is your, I mean, yeah, it's your battle plan, you know?
Yeah.
And that is a tricky part of it. Yeah, how do you share those things? How do you like, I mean, I remember doing those player interviews with like Pablo and with Reagans and Tyone, and they're telling me exactly like what they were thinking and doing. And I was just like, I'm so happy right now.
Yeah, it's so hard with hitters, man.
Right?
I think like, one of my best interviews have been with like recently retired hitters or hitters are about to retire. Adam Dunn told me a lot in his last year. And when I went and cleared something with him, I was like, oh, you mind if I say this? You said this? And he goes, yo, man, I'm retiring. Put it down. Burn it. Burn the whole place down. And I was like, oh, do you want to say something about Billy Bean on the way out?
Oh, my God.
But so one of my favorite things was a story between Zach Greinke and Paul Konerko. And Zach Greinke said that Paul Konerko was basically quick pitching him, that Paul Konerko was pretending to not be ready at the plate. And so Greinke saw that, he thought Konerko wasn't ready at the plate. This is before the pitch clock. So Greinke just throws a 90 mile an hour fastball down the pipe, just being like, I'm going to quick pitch him. He's not ready. And Konerko blasts it 450 feet, like 4 feet foul. And Greinke's like, you bastard. Later in that same plate appearance, it gets down to like the two strike situation. And I think it was Konerko who would like shift his back foot so that basically everything would go oppo. He would shift.
He would come in. So essentially pulling his back foot back.
And like kind of just turn his whole body to oppo field so that he could like see it longer and just like push it to the opposite field. And Konerko saw that. And I think he struck him out with a fastball inside or something.
Oh, yeah. So Greinke was like, cool, you're trying to do that. Right.
And
so
I talked to Konerko and Greinke about it. And Konerko was like, oh, yeah, I was totally trying to do that. I was pretending I wasn't ready.
Oh, man. So that's actually, I don't think that gets talked about enough, is that hitters, if you're trying to go to a certain direction, all you do, it's very straightforward, is like, well, okay, let's say your feet are parallel. That means you are going towards center field. If your feet are not parallel, then they are like wherever they're parallel to is the direction that they want it to go. So it's called when stepping in the bucket when you're a kid.
Yeah, but what do the stepping
in
the bucket guys want to do? They want to yank homers.
Well, right. They're trying to open up so that the bat is just facing towards left field.
Yeah.
Right. So you want more pull fly balls. You want to step in the bucket, which means you do not throw them anything inside. Like that one time, you know, the only time in my life that I've actually intentionally tried to throw at someone, save for the one time that my coach told me to in college, just another story. But I remember this. We were getting blown out.
Nice coach you got there.
Oh, man. We were getting blown out. Okay. It was we're up 15 runs. And the guy, it's like a metal bat league, comes up with a wooden bat. Okay.
Oh, you just wanted to hit him?
Right. And I could see him jeering with his friends. Like, I'm going to do this.
Oh, yeah.
So I throw two steamers, right? And I remember throwing
it. You wanted to break his bat is what you wanted to do.
Well, right. I wanted to break his bat. But he's a lefty and I'm a righty. I'm like, oh, okay. But so I'm like, you know, I'm going to throw it right at his thigh. You know, because I'm like, I can't go at the ribs. I can't do that. I can't, you know, I'm like too worried I'll hit them in the head. I'm like, all right, I'm going to put this just right in your thigh. Like, go to first. And I throw it at his thigh and it comes back a little bit. And he just steps in the bucket and rips a double down the line. I was like, this is the worst. I'm like, also, you stepped in the bucket. Yeah. Like,
it looked terrible, by the way. That double looked terrible.
The other time I actually did, this is ridiculous. I know this is a tangent, guys. I'm really sorry, but I was in college and I was the reliever who would pitch like in every game. Like that was my role. And I remember coming to a game again, a blowout. We were losing. Came into it with a man on first. This is literally the first batter that I'm facing. So the second batter, I got the first guy out on the ground or whatever, man on first and one out. The batter comes up and I throw the pitch and he squares the bunt. We're down like 12 to 1. It's like one of the last innings of this game. Okay. Next, before I throw the next pitch, the coach comes out and doesn't even make it to the mound. Like he just goes one step over the foul line and he steps forward and says, put this next pitch in his ribs. Okay. That's all he does. You know, right. I didn't want to curse there. Right. And that's what he does. And like, I think the other team could hear this, you know, like it's so obvious what he just said. You know, I'm like, you know, I've never done anything like this really in this way. And I don't want to hit the guy. I just want to pitch. I just want to, you know, I can get this guy out, no problem. And so my catcher is there with me, you know, and he goes,
he knows you don't want to do it.
He goes, okay. Just gives me that look. And he goes back. I'm like, oh God. All right. I got it. Okay. I see this guy. He's also like clearly the pinch hitter who's like getting his opportunity, you know, and the coach just told him to bunt, you know, so he's doing it. And I'm like, oh God. All right. And I go down and I look in for the sign. Got to say this. The catcher gives me the fastball sign, but with the middle finger, which is hilarious. Never seen that before. Never. And I'm trying to hold it together. Like, emotions are going nuts. And so I come to the set. I'm like, this is okay. All right. Same thought process as before. I don't want to put it in his ribs. I don't want to. So I'm trying to go for his thigh, right? Again, it's another lefty for whatever reason. And I throw these two seamers. I have like two plane sink and everything. So I aim for his thigh. He squares around a bunt. I swear to you, I hit him straight in the kneecap.
Oh!
And the ball goes up in the air, you know.
And he sits down on the ground screaming.
Dude. We're just soldiers in this war. Oh, no. Like, you didn't want to bunt. I didn't want to hit you. Like, I'm sorry, dude.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah. Don't
Did
step
he stay in the
bunt,
game dude. Or he was out?
Never bunt.
Did he stay in the game? And
that is a great transition into.
You're not going to tell me he stayed in the game? Did he stay in the game?
What was the game? This game was like college.
No, did he stay in the game, the hitter?
Or oh,
did he,
absolutely not.
Oh, God. No.
He didn't even make it one step towards first. He was on the ground.
Oh, no.
Oh, my gosh. That was not quick. But Joe Boyle is the transition here because he doesn't know where it's going either. And we have him 75.
I do.
Do you actually believe he's going to start regularly for the Rays?
Yeah. I do think so. I think, okay. You know, here's one thing about the Rays. Ian Seymour has options, and Joe Boyle has an option technically, but he's also at the poop or get off the potty point in his career. where, you know, he's either going to go to the bullpen. This is probably the last year I would try him as a starter. Like, if it doesn't work this year, I think he just goes to the pen and he's basically a closer, and maybe he can close for them. But, you know, I don't think there's that much more to learn about Ian Seymour. So I think that to begin the season, you know, Seymour's in the minors and Boyle gets his chance. Yeah, there's okay, also just
Math is also Shane, there, which is
Shane
wild.
McClanahan is, yeah, you know, is he going to make it to opening day? And then like Steven Matz is like, it's a project, and I think it may not work out because, you know, they've tried Matz as a starter a lot. And I think a lot of the gains that he had and stuff models and stuff like that are more just, you know, gaining velocity, going to the pen. I think he's at this point, like a better reliever. So basically what I'm saying is the projections are amazing based on the stuff, obviously, but also based on he's going to a nice new park. This is going to be the first time that he gets a dome park where like the pitches all do exactly what they're supposed to do.
Sure.
He's changed his arm slot. I think he's got, I think he's got a little bit more command with this. They do the one target thing for him. Basically everything's set up for him to succeed. And there are two or three ways that to assure that he keeps his rotation slot, which is Shane gets hurt, Matz doesn't work out, Seymour doesn't have a great spring, or, you know, they just decide he'd be better off in the minors.
So very good points there. I do believe that Ian Seymour has to be starting on this team. I mean, I know that they didn't want to bring him up because it was just such bad numbers in like AAA, and like the stuff, all the models like hated it, and they're like, they didn't want to even bring him up in the first place because of it. But it's just, I can't fathom that they don't. I would also imagine the Rays are going to get some discount starter. Like,
it's
a Rays move to find value in some rando that is cheap and will give them volume. Because, yeah, you're just making this great point that, like, they do not have depth at all. Even in, like, looking at AAA, I don't feel like they're just going to instantly call up, like, Joe Rock or something like that. It just doesn't... I feel like they need to add someone there. And I don't believe in Steve Matz. So yeah, maybe Joe Boyle is, but let's even just say that Joe Boyle is in the rotation to start the year. He is exactly the kind of guy I try to avoid these days.
Zero stop, zero command.
Not actually know how to feel about Joe Boyle. You know, we like to say like, oh, he's just not looking good or whatever, but then you're saying, oh, well, maybe the next start will be better. And like, oh, you're just five innings and like only one walk or something. It's a hipster. To me, Hedy can do something with the entire roster. And personally, for me, I'm just like, I don't want to touch it. You make a great point about the dome, about going from Steinbrenner to Tropicana. I've been saying that for Pepio and Rasmussen, but I haven't for Boyle because, yeah, Boyle, right. We got a different lens of him at George Steinbrenner Field. So
I mean, that's what Pepio was saying, was, you know, he said all the Rays starters were looking up at the board for their movement numbers.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to know how their pitches were moving that day, because the wind is so erratic there that it was changing them. You know, they would get like 24 inches on their sweeper sometimes because they're like, you know, the wind is blowing that way. it's blowing it sideways. So, I don't know. I think that could be useful for him. I wanted to get him in my top 75 with a projection that good. Maybe it's aggressive. Maybe that changes. Just a real shout out before we're done here. The two names, you know, I think that Boyle could move, you know, with more information when we go into spring. You talked about that at the top of this, that there's so much more information to come.
Right. Right.
We didn't get to them, but like Robbie Snelling and Jacob Latz were two that you kind of circled on my list.
Right. Like Latz, I'm in on, and I assumed that with the Mackenzie Gore trade and something else, I guess, that he wasn't going to start. But I checked it after. I was like, wait, hold on a second. Like, it's Kumar Rocker is the other one. And we don't know what the Rangers are going to do with him. So Latz, I like that you're in on Latz.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, with Rocker, he hasn't figured out lefties yet, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that I guess they have Cal Quantrill. I missed that one.
The unquantifiable, yes.
But Tyler Alexander, I think, gives them lefty redundancy in the bullpen. He's kind of what Latz was last year, like a stretched lefty in the bullpen.
He can't go too long because he has short arms. He's a T-Lex. Keep going, please.
So anyway, they don't need Lats of the bullpen. They could use Rocker the bullpen. Like, they could actually use a dominant closer. So right. I'm not saying that Rocker to the bullpen is happening this year. I'm just saying I don't think that Rocker's figured out lefties, and I think he could start in the minors. And then with Snelling, I guess it's just a bet a little bit against Jansen Junk. Jansen Junk basically just had the 2019 Miles Michaelis season, which did not presage a lot of dominance afterwards. I don't know if you can remember what happened after that.
Just not anything we should focus on, say, for like 1 year of like 23 or something like that.
Oh, yeah. There was one good year. That was great
defense for Cardinals defense.
Good luck trying to get that one good year. No, but Junk is a very similar to Miles Michaelis, I think. Mm-hmm. Very good command, not great stuff in a good park. I'm not saying he's not useful, but I think that Snelling finds a way to sneak into that rotation. Maybe,
yeah, I think
by injury, maybe there's a lot of injury risk. Max Myers,
Yeah,
Myers in there, Braxton Garrett. These are a lot of these guys have been injured.
Yeah,
so that's something to watch for. We've given you a watch list,
right? I mean, so I haven't done the breakdown of the Marlins yet for my as I go through every single team, and I'm really excited about that one to really determine like, okay, how much am I in on Robbie Snelling and Thomas White and Noble Meyer, like as prospect pitchers coming up? Are they in the like auto ad? Are they in the inspec ad? Are they in like, we'll kind of see how this pans out. I imagine they're at the very least of the spec ad for each of them, if not at the auto ad. And it will be fun to see like who actually battles that out. We've got
Noble Meyer hitting,
Noble
Meyer hitting 99 in offseason workouts.
Yeah, hitting.
I know, but he didn't hit that before. He was pretty low velo guy.
So that's okay. Hitting is always the word that I'm like, that's
yeah,
it's the wrong first letter.
Yeah,
but Zebby Matthews is the one that I am going to push back a little bit on, just to mention at the end of this, just because it's a weird case where I just don't trust the guy's command in the zone. I think that Zebby is a like, I'll get it in the zone or whatever, but not actually utilizing things correctly. Like, so many of his cutters and sliders were down and inside the zone. Against lefties where they can't be there. The fastball is not getting upstairs. He does not feel like a pitcher that executes properly. You know, it's like
interesting
doing
because
the job,
for me,
kind of like watching Walker Buehler pitch for the Red Sox. It's like, this is a slider. This is a cutter. That's the only way, not the stuff-wise. Stuff-wise, well, obviously, way better.
Yeah.
But I meant like just how he's executing.
Oh, okay.
And it's not like, oh, puts this here and then goes there and does this and does that. You know,
Zebby and Melton are like Troy Melton are in terms of the model, like beautiful. Like it's just like they just have multiple pitches with grid stuff plus good location plus. They have some prospect pedigree. Like I get what you're saying, but I think sometimes that explains why he was bad last year. And I don't know that will explain why he's going to be bad this year.